I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Home prices have been increasing at a rate not seen since 2006. The S&P Case-Shiller Index of 20 U.S. cities found that the price for a single-family house rose almost 10% in the last year, from February 2012 to February 2013. The increase in Phoenix and Las Vegas areas was even bigger. The housing boom and bust did profound injury to the U.S. economy and to millions of homeowners who lost their homes or had their homes lose much of their value. So what are we supposed to make of all these new findings? We have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. Todd Sinai is Associate Professor of Real Estate and Business Economics and Public Policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Todd, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks, Marty.
And on the telephone is Stan Humphries, Chief Economist for Zillow, and that's a real estate information site. And Stan Humphries, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Hi, Marty. Delighted to be with you.
Stan, let me begin with you looking at these numbers from the S&P Case-Shiller Index. Are we seeing a blip, a trend, a rebound? How do you understand these numbers?
Well, it's definitely a strong bounce off of the bottom. And I think we need to, the Case-Shiller numbers, we need to take with a little bit of grain of salt in that they are looking at, they do include foreclosure resales, and because of that inclusion, as the mix of foreclosures across the year changes, Case-Shiller tends to be a bit more volatile than an index that excludes foreclosures. So, and it also tends to be a little bit more weighted towards the coastal metros, which of course saw higher run-ups, bigger declines, and now bigger rebounds. But still, by any index, even in Zillow's index, we're up 5.1% for the end of March for the past year, which is, of course, quite high appreciation rate. So we are seeing a pretty big bounce off the bottom, and I think generally that's being driven by tight inventory and in the marketplace and pretty robust demand. A lot of that demand being made up by investors right now.
And I want to pick up on all that. A bounce off the bottom, Todd, do you see it that way?
Yeah, I see this not really as the beginning of a boom, but maybe the end of a bust. And it's not universal. I mean, Stan, I agree with you completely about the issues with looking at the Case-Shiller Index. If you look at indices of conforming mortgages, sort of Phoenix is up 12% instead of 23%. It's still up a lot, and I think it's going to go up more this selling season. But if you're in Tallahassee, right, you're not seeing that at all. All right, so the set of cities that show up in the Case-Shiller numbers, which are the ones that we've sort of just seen, are a set of cities that tend to boom and bust more than others. And we're coming out of the bust, and now they're starting to boom, and we're seeing that. But you wouldn't want to say that's happening all the way across the U.S.
And how about here in Philadelphia? Any sense of what's going on? I'll toss that first to you, Todd, and then to you, Stan.
I think Stan will have more current numbers than I do. But the last I've looked at is Philadelphia is fairly flat as a metro. Now, within the metropolitan area, that's going to include the suburbs who are doing better and maybe the city who's flatter or various things happening within the metro. But on a whole, kind of just hanging out there.
And that's kind of typical for this area, is it not, Todd?
Well, yeah, we're less volatile than other areas. Now, and of course, hanging out there and not doing much is better than going down. And we've been going down for 5 years. And so I think as a mark of what feels like around the bottom, this is feeling kind of like that.
What do you think, Stan, as you look at this area?
Yeah, so Philadelphia, as Todd indicated, is definitely seeing a little bit of a flatter recovery, but also it was not one of the big boom and bust markets like San Francisco or Miami or Los Angeles. Nationally, as I said, for the past year, we see home values up about 5.1%, and in the Philadelphia metro, we see them pretty much flat, just up 0.2% for the year. And then a lot of variation across the metro with the city itself, Philadelphia being down about 1.2%, and then places like Camden being up strongly, about 4.5%, and Wilmington being up about 1.6%. So a lot of variation. It looks in your metro as though, as you head further east, a lot of those cities and areas are doing a little bit better than some of the parts that are more eastern. I'm sorry, more western in your metro.
And Stan, how much of the issue of supply and demand is driving these prices as we look across the country? Can we winnow it down to those two issues?
Yes, largely. I think really the supply issues are definitely a big part of the overall housing dynamic right now. Nationally, we have inventory down from, if you look at the amount of for sale inventory available to the consumers in February of this year relative to February of last year, nationally that's down about 17%. And the Philadelphia market is down even more, about 18%. So that means that if a home shopper wading into the market to try to find a home to buy is finding in Philadelphia 18% less inventory than they did the year before. And, of course, those inventory constraints do, in the end, translate into price appreciation, because if it's harder to find a home, then right. people will bid up the price of those homes that are available. And then, in turn, that a lot of those inventory shortages are a story driven by negative equity itself, which negative equity, of course, is the situation in which a homeowner would find their current value of the home being less than the outstanding mortgage balance. And nationally, we believe that about just over 27% of homeowners with a mortgage are in negative equity. In the Philadelphia metro, that's quite, a little bit lower than the national numbers. We think just over 23, between 23 and 24% of homeowners with a mortgage are in negative equity. And that negative equity does mean that there are a lot of homeowners who, given an increase in demand that we're seeing now as mainstream buyers return to the marketplace, they might choose to normally sell their homes to these new entrants and either exit the market or find another home. And that's just not happening right now because a lot of these, with almost a quarter of homeowners with a mortgage underwater, they can't sell their house. So that means there's just less liquidity in the marketplace right now, and that lower liquidity does lead to some price volatility.
Do you want to add anything to that, Todd?
Well, the whole question of demand and supply is actually a big, complicated question, and there are lots of things going on. On the supply side, we've ended up with way too much supply by the end of 2007. But after that, we were building houses across the country and something on the order of 500,000 units a year, where ordinarily we average between 1.5 million and 2 million units a year. All right, so we, for the last 5 years or so, have significantly undersupplied what would be a naturally growing market. We're now starting to see supply start to come back. So I think the number of new units started for this year is approaching 1 million, of which maybe 600,000 are single-family detached homes. Mm. That's still well below the trend that we would need to have in order to have keep up with what's going to be what Stan called a return to sort of normal demand in the market.
And a growing population, wanting to buy a house.
Well, so the growing population wanting to buy a house is an interesting part of the whole demand part, right? So we just finished with supply. On the demand side, the home ownership rate going into the mid-2000s was on the order of 70%. Now it's 65%. And if you look at the numbers, there were about 75 million homeowners in 2007, and there are about 75 million homeowners now. And so the population grew by, maybe 5 million households who all became renters, right, instead of any of them becoming homeowners. And so that is a large overhang of households who at some point, probably some of them are going to get back into the market. They're unlikely to become renters forever. Now, it's interesting because then the question is, well, who's not selling to them? What we see is that actually the home ownership rate did not fall. It went up among people age 16 and over. It fell considerably among people age 45 and below. And the number of homeowners over the age of 65 went up. And the number of homeowners below the age of 45 went down even more than the 5 million. So what seems to be happening is that people are not leaving their homes as they get older. Now, why that is, I'm not quite sure. It could be that they just can't afford to retire and sell their house and cash out of it. Or they just don't want to sell at current prices and they want to wait. But I think one of the big questions is, does liquidity in the market increase when the older homeowners start selling their houses and the younger homeowners start buying them from them?
Let me pick up on something that Todd said and toss this to you, Stan, which has to do with renters. And one of the issues that has come up as we've talked about the economy over the last couple of years, and certainly people who are underwater, who have lost value in their homes, or perhaps even lost a job, that all of a sudden renting looks more attractive because it gives a person a mobility. They're not tied to their house if a job is, let's say, halfway across the country. Does that make sense, do you think?
It does in general. I mean, and there's certainly whole classes of people for which renting does make a lot of sense, and certainly the younger or folks early in their career, it makes a ton of sense because you tend to be quite mobile there, and having the flexibility of being able to move wherever you want is a nice aspect of renting. But in general, during the course of the housing recession, mm-hmm. buying is increasingly looked more attractive because home prices were falling, and then now we have the situation where home prices are not only have been reset a number of years. I mean, nationally, home values are back to about 2004 levels, wow. maybe early 2003, depending wow. on the market. But you pair that with basically the Federal Reserve marking down mortgage rates. So essentially, the Federal Reserve at this point is largely subsidizing housing for many people. So you have a situation where affordability is just extraordinarily high, which has made buying look really attractive. And that's certainly a big part of the demand profile is that people, as household formation rates get back up to normal levels, a lot of them are choosing to buy instead of rent in a lot of these markets. That we did an analysis a couple months ago that kind of looked at the break-even horizon or how long you have to live in a house to make buying more financially advantageous than renting. And we found that in 60% of the metros we looked at, which was 150-odd metros, buying became more advantageous than renting after only 3 years.
Wow.
Which is not a very long horizon.
No, it isn't.
In places like Detroit, it was under 2 years, which means that almost the default strategy, unless you're really going to be there for less than a year, was to buy a home. And that's driven by, just, again, the high affordability we're seeing in a lot of markets.
And what's the basic interest rate that people are paying these days if they're getting a mortgage?
Well, as of this morning in the Zillow Marketplace, it was about 3.4% for a 30-year fixed. Which is just extraordinary. Incredibly low.
Yeah, I remember buying a house years and years and decades ago. I think it paid 12 or 15%. I mean, that's extraordinary, Todd.
Actually, when you think about the affordability of that, I mean, by our calculation, basically, between 1985 and 2000, people spent about 20%. If you look at the price of the median home in the country and then take the mortgage rate, and figure out the monthly payment, it was about 20%. That was just on principal and interest, not including taxes and everything else. But they spent about 20% of their monthly income on the mortgage payment, and now they're spending, as of the fourth quarter of 2012, just over 12%. So,
huge
difference. That's incredibly affordable.
Todd, go ahead. Looks like you want to add something.
Oh, well, I mean, I think the one of the big stories of the current housing market is that 3.5% interest rate. So, I hopefully a number of your listeners do remember when interest rates actually were in double digits. That does happen.
It does.
What Stan alludes to about the relative cost of owning and renting. So what's driving that shift of those 5 million households? 5 million households is a huge number relative to the housing market when they shift out of the housing market and if they shift back in. So what's driving that decision is that they're hanging out and renting. As you mentioned, you want to be a renter if you have a need for mobility in the relatively short term. But there's a point at which owning becomes financially advantageous. I've been tracking this for a long time, and I have never seen the cost of owning being so cheap relative to renting as it is right now.
Let me pick up on that, and then we are going to take a very short break, talk with Todd Sinai and Stan Humphries about the real estate market, and take some calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Are you living with relentless pain? St. Mary offers a new way to help, the Rapid Recovery Program for knee and hip replacements, designed to promote faster recovery, with patients walking just hours after surgery. St. Mary offers custom-fit joints to help promote a pain-free life. Details at stmaryhealthcare.org/joints. St. Mary Medical Center in Langhorne, supporting WHYY. It's your health. Expect more.
Let me take these few seconds to thank the many listeners who expressed support of our program services during HYY's recent campaign. You continue to come through at a time of further declines in traditional sources of revenue. The result? Well, it matters tremendously. I'm Bill Morazzo, WHYY's president, and thanks to you, we're growing our investments in program services, and they're designed to help you stay engaged in your community. You count on us, and we count on you. Thank you.
Tina Gordon Chisholm made her name in Hollywood writing films like Drumline and ATL. Now she's making her directing debut with the new comedy Peoples. It has the backing of hit filmmaker Tyler Perry and features major stars like Diane Carroll and Kerry Washington. So how'd she do? Tina Gordon Chisholm takes us behind the scenes of her new film Peoples next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. Near record low interest rates, a shortage of inventory perhaps are fueling a sign of at least small recovery when it comes to the housing market. What does it mean for sellers and buyers and the economy at large? And what about all those homeowners who are still underwater? Stan Humphries joining us by telephone, chief economist for Zillow, that's a real estate information site, and Todd Sinai with us here in our Philadelphia studio, associate professor of real estate, business, economics, and public policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And we got a lot of calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Todd, you were talking about how attractive the market is, but expand on that if you could.
Yeah, if you were to try and figure out how much owning a house would cost you over the next year or for a year or so, and compare it to how much it would cost to rent over the next year, owning looks really, really favorable on a cost basis. And this is what's showing up in Stan's break-even calculations. I think the issue is that was true last year, and that was true the year before, and it was true the year before that, and we didn't see an influx of people into the housing market, in part because I think when people go to buy houses, they are worried about, if I buy it this year and it's worth 5% less next year, I really want to wait. And that creates a bunch of nervousness. And so I think one of the things that's going to be very important going forward is, have we hit the point where people become comfortable returning to the housing market? Because as Stan was mentioning, buying a house is the way that you get a 3.5% mortgage. And if you're looking at the housing market and thinking, well, I could rent or could I own, but if I buy, I can lock in a 3.5% interest rate, that becomes a very favorable proposition.
But that gets to the issue of trust. I'm thinking about the kind of mistrust of the banking system that happened after the, you know, the implosion of a couple of years ago. The question is, you know, do we trust the real estate market?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, you know, part of it is that I think people get hung up on thinking about the real estate market in the short run, right? It is very hard to figure out what's going to happen next year, what's going to happen 3 years from now, what's going to happen 5 years from now. It's much easier to think about owning real estate for long term. And really, when you're thinking about buying a house and making a commitment to a house, that requires a degree of stability in your life to be able to do that. And that's a long-term decision.
Stan, let me go back to you, and I'm interested, and there's always this comparison between Philadelphia and New York, and I've always wondered why people in New York are willing to pay just gobs of money to live in a closet. And you can get a pretty nice house in Philadelphia for not a lot of money, certainly compared to New York City. What do you think explains that difference?
Well, I guess what really explains it is just the demand for the New York amenities in the New York market itself, and there are a lot of jobs that New York will have that Philadelphia doesn't that turn out to be incredibly high wage earning jobs, and so that has created a marketplace. Which, I mean, New York is really quite unusual, where, you know, the metro itself is actually, you know, still kind of mired. It's not a great recovery story, the larger metro, but the five boroughs in Manhattan specifically is really had hardly a housing recession at all.
Amazing.
And which is amazing because there are places, you know, like San Francisco is a market that by all is very similar in a lot of ways, but it had a very sizable housing recession. It seems as though what happens in New York is that it's just increasing concentration of wealth within those five boroughs such that you can maintain escalating home prices even above a historical normal rate of appreciation just by replacing the people who were in the city with more wealthier people over time, and that will increase home prices, even though nationally income growth has been relatively flat and even down during the recession. So, you know, the New York story is a really interesting one.
Yeah.
It's a market unlike any other.
A market unlike any other, perhaps even in the world. But I'm going back to you, Todd, and even going back to Philadelphia, I've interviewed a number of people, artists, you know, actors. They come to Philadelphia because they can afford it. I mean, there is a positive side to having affordable housing, it seems to me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I came here from Boston. I feel Philadelphia is now where Boston was 20 years ago, before the chefs and the artists got priced out of those gentrifying markets. But the mechanism is one that's going to be pretty much a fact of life for the major cities in this country, which is the places that people typically want to live, that have the greatest amenities, the New Yorks, the San Franciscos, the LAs, the Bostons, are ones where the people who can live there are sort of the top of the pyramid. And we're in a mobile enough world that people in those professions can choose where they live, and there are enough of them that they can fill up those cities. And so the story of New York and San Francisco has been going on for decades. So if you look over 40 years, San Francisco house prices have outpaced inflation by 3% per year, more than the average. Right? So you have cities that they were unaffordable in 1990, they're unaffordable for the average person in 2000, they're unaffordable in 2010, but they are completely affordable for the people who actually buy those houses.
Because they have the good jobs that have a good salary.
And it's an international market now, so they can go in. Philadelphia gets the cast-offs in a way. In a good way, because it's a creative class and it leads to the growth of the next tier of cities that will eventually follow the same profile.
Stan, are we also seeing we're witnessing a growing gap between rich and middle class and poor people in this country? Is that also true then for the housing market, which you have these big McMansions that are being built, and then you've got people struggling with foreclosures and houses underwater?
Yes, that's distinctly true. And if you think, just to add a point onto Todd's about kind of San Francisco and New York, there are an increase. There's basically a sorting that happens, and that sorting is becoming more acute in terms of income and educational segmentation within America, where your more highly educated, high income earners are gravitating much more to your coastal metros. Mm-hmm. Like San Francisco, L.A., New York, Washington, Boston, Philadelphia, places like that. If you look relative to 30, 40 years ago of the educational patterns across the U.S., they were much more evenly spread. You were just as likely to bump into a college graduate or someone with a master's, across the U.S. It was more of a uniform distribution, and now there's much more of a very peaked distribution where those people are living. The people with higher educational levels are living in your coastal kind of elite cities, mm-hmm. And that of course then is reflected in home prices, as Todd indicated. And then the home ownership rates in those two, in comparing San Francisco and New York, the consequence of those escalating home prices, there are people who can pay ever higher prices, but the home ownership rates are also quite a bit less because the home prices are so high that. Some people can afford the homes and buy them. The rest are renting, and so the home ownership rates in places like New York and San Francisco will be lower than places like Cleveland or that have lower price, or in Austin that has more affordable housing.
Okay.
So, and I guess just another follow-on point about kind of the impact on the prior topic of kind of mortgage rates. I just wanted to make the point that. How much of the kind of current environment around affordability, one concern we have is that so much of that is now predicated, is being driven by the fact that mortgage rates are so low, that certainly there's been a big reset in home prices, but we are increasingly concerned that, that as Todd indicated, housing works best when people think about it as a long-term asset, and our concern is that, in some of these markets that are seeing such great recoveries, like San Francisco and Southern California, a lot of that affordability is increasingly just a function of that very low mortgage rate. And if you crank in a mortgage rate that's more like 5-6%, suddenly those markets don't quite seem as affordable as they do now. And we'll be back in that environment by late 2015, early 2016. So it's not a near-term concern, but our worry is that we'll continue to see pretty high price appreciation in those markets. And then by 2015, when rates go back to normal, they'll appear high. And we'll see flattening of home prices or even declines in some of those markets. So it's a concern for more near-term buyers. Anyone buying a home with kind of more of a 3 to 5 year horizon, it kind of gets us worried in some of those markets.
And that's Stan Humphries. He's chief economist for Zillow. That's a real estate information site. And again, Todd Sinai with us here in our Philadelphia studios, associate professor of real estate and business economics and public policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. We are talking about the housing market, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get, looks like Ed from Cherry Hill to join us. And Ed, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
In response to the comment that the economist from Zillow just made, that was really the comment that I was going for. I spent 20 years as a market analyst at Fannie Mae, and one of the things that we observed is that the property cycle lasts about 18 to 20 years. We're coming out of the trough now, and these low interest rates are driving what activity there is, but there's not a corresponding increase in household income. So the affordable housing equation is going to start working against people as property prices increase, as was noted. We're going to get to a point at some point as we come out of the trough when the housing price will exclude a high enough number of potential home buyers that markets will begin to soften and perhaps crash again. There's the problem, as I see it, is that there's not enough underlying strength in the economy, particularly with regard to household savings and income. So I wonder if your two guests would comment on that observation.
It's an interesting observation, Ed. Let me toss that to you, Todd Sinai. This, you know, perhaps disconnect between income and assets and savings and a house price.
Yeah, I think Ed is absolutely right in that the prime driver of the housing market is income. It's having a job and having an income that lets you afford a house. I think this last year, was the first year where we saw employment, like the number of households people employed, grow faster than the housing stock. Okay, in the recent, because the number of people actually employed was declining for a while. And so now we're starting to hopefully see enough of growth in the economy to support some of the housing market. A large part of the housing market gets supported just because even if the unemployment rate has gone down, gone up and then come down a bit, we don't have all that many more houses. So it's the number of people employed in the incomes of those people rather than the fraction of them. And so the fraction could have gotten worse, but we have a larger base to operate on, and that helps bring the housing market back. But overall, I think we are coming into the beginning part of the next cycle. And so if you have a horizon of living in the house for 18 to 20 years, the trends are kind of working in your favor, right? Most of the country, houses don't appreciate much more than the rate of inflation. And in a handful of the coastal cities, they exceed the rate of inflation by a percentage point or two. And there's tremendous volatility in house prices around that. And you don't want to be caught at the bottom of that volatility.
Stan, it has been a kind of accepted belief, and perhaps even part of this American dream, which was to own a house, and that would be the asset that you could retire on, you could use to, you know, help your children go to college. I mean, seen as something that you could use to aspire to that next rung on the economic ladder. And I think there are just a lot of questions about whether a house still operates that way.
Well, I think in general it does. I mean, I guess as an asset class, housing is, you know, not as spectacular as, say, equities. I mean, you know, generally what Todd said is exactly right, that generally housing keeps up with basically inflation or the growth in incomes. So, I mean, we expect it to grow in nominal terms, say 3-4% a year, right, whereas equities we expect to grow maybe 8% annualized. So as an investment class, it's not a, you know, super great investment if you just had money sitting around that you're going to put in various asset classes. You might, you know, choose some real estate, but it's not going to be the highest performing asset class for you. But the difference is that, of course, you live in your house. So there, it makes a big difference, because for many Americans, homeownership is essentially a pathway to middle class status because of the fact that the mortgage becomes a forced savings plan that requires you to sock away a non-trivial amount of money each month into this account that is backed by typically a non-depreciating asset like a house. So over time, that means that if you're in the house for 20, 30 years, you end up basically with that house being owned free and clear, and the house is worth a bunch of money, which helps you accumulate wealth. Now, typically, housing is a non-depreciating asset, except for, the past 5-6 years when it was quite a depreciating asset. Right. But generally, I think it'll go back to a period. You know, I think our expectation is that we're going to see some continued volatility, probably through really the end of this decade, where we think that we don't think we've just had a housing run-up and then a single bust, a single correction, and that's kind of the end of it. Instead, we think we've kind of entered a period of of oscillating periods, they're going to increasingly be dampened over time. So we do expect some markets to see further declines in the out years, but that to be moderate. And then as we head to the back half of the decade, we think that housing will go back to being a little bit more normal asset, where it grows at 3-4% a year. But generally, it is a, you know, as I said, because of that forced savings mechanism, it can be a way to accumulate wealth over time.
Yeah, go ahead, Tom.
Yeah, I think an important point about housing at retirement is that, you know, as Stan said, by the time people get to retirement, they have largely paid off their mortgage. By the time people are age 70 in the data, they have almost no mortgage debt. But they do have a house. And the value of the house is not how much price growth you're going to think you're going to get, because it's going to get kind of minimal over the very long run. The value of the house is that you get to live there and you're not paying rent to someone. Right? And so what happens to someone at retirement is they now own this house that they get to live in and not pay rent for the next 30 years. And what they're doing is paying property taxes and they're maintaining it. And that's very valuable. If you thought about how much you would have to save in order to be able to afford rent throughout retirement, that's a very large number. And so the value of the house is that it effectively provides an annuity. What we want seniors to do is annuitize. It provides that for them at retirement. And so it is still an important part of saving for them.
Let me get Justin from Westchester to join us. And Justin, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. My question, it's more of a comment and then a kind of a question at the end. But my question is Marty was saying earlier in the program that she remembers paying like 10-12% for her house.
Yep.
And I imagine, let's just say, for example, the house is worth $100,000. Now, let's say the house is worth $250,000, but she could get the mortgage for 3% instead of 10 or 12. Has the real value of the house changed at all? Do you understand my question?
Yes. In fact, like, I see Todd nodding vigorously. Justin, let me get around. And I'm sure, Stan, you have something to say as well. Go ahead.
You know, Justin, you're absolutely right. So you were thinking about the world and how much is it going to cost me to pay for the house, right? And at a 3.5% interest rate, the interest costs on a $200,000 house are $7,000 a year. And at a 12% interest rate, the interest costs on a $200,000 house is $24,000 a year. And so if you have $10,000 to spend, you can no longer afford to pay a $200,000 house at that higher interest rate. And so we think, well, what you would be willing to pay and therefore would go down, and therefore house prices would go down. That makes very good sense. Now, it's not just interest costs that go into it, so it doesn't quite work exactly one for one that way, but that's basically the idea. And when interest rates are as low as they are now, we are extremely sensitive to changes in interest rates, because going up by 2 or 3% is almost doubling your interest costs. It's a big change off of a couple hundred basis points. When Marty bought her first house, a 2 percentage point decline is only 16%, which is a much smaller fraction, would have a much smaller effect on prices. So we do think interest rates are going to affect prices a lot. I think the question is, well, what is going to induce rates to rise? If what makes rates rise is that the Fed is trying to put the brakes on a growing economy, well, then the income that you have to pay for the house has gone up when the interest rates have gone up, and those two kind of offset. And so how that offsetting works is sort of the number one, you know, $64,000 question, as it were. And then if you think the Fed is going to pay attention and not raise interest rates in a way that's going to damage the housing market because they need the housing market to drive the recovery, then you get a little less worried about that. But that's a big issue.
Justin, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Stan, if you want to add to what Todd just said, we will have to do that after this very short break. We are talking about the real estate market, home prices, interest rates. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Philadelphia Hospitality presents Philadelphia Open House, May 13th through 19th, featuring behind-the-scenes tours of more than 15 historical and cultural treasures. PhilaHospitality.org or 215-790-9901, extension 11.
How angry am I? You don't want to know. Nobody wants to know. That's the opening lines of Claire Massoud's new novel, The Woman Upstairs. It's about a single woman who hasn't fulfilled her dream of being an artist and a mother. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Massoud, who also wrote the bestseller, The Emperor's Children. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. As the Boston bombing investigation continues, we'll speak with Muslims who want to tell us what they think their role is in monitoring members of their mosque. Also, what is the enduring appeal of The Great Gatsby? Our critic reads it every summer. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY. Coastal Spine in South Jersey supports WHYY, providing physical therapy, spinal injections, EMGs, and minimally invasive surgery options for neck and back pain. CoastalSpine.com or 856-222-4444.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Wasn't so long ago that housing values were in free fall and nearly brought down the U.S. economy. This was after a boom in the housing market. Looks like housing prices have been inching their way up in parts of the country. We're talking about what's fueling this increase. What does it mean for buyers and sellers? What about homeowners who are underwater, and have the lessons of the boom and bust been learned? Talking with Stan Humphries, chief economist for Zillow, and Todd Sinai, professor of real estate at the Wharton School at Penn, and of course taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stan, anything you wanted to add before we took that break?
Well, I think I was just going to point out that the caller's reference about were you paying more, Marty, for your house back in the day versus now, and another important consideration to consider there is, of course, the impact of inflation. That while I said that home prices increase 3-4% a year, that's in nominal terms. I mean, in real terms, usually housing is relatively flat. I mean, basically, if it's keeping pace with inflation or growth in income, that means that in real terms, it's not really changing. So yes, there is a difference that if you were paying, 12% on a mortgage back in the 70s on a lower price house, the house is more expensive now, but you're paying a lower financing rate. That there is a difference in, because of course your incomes have grown over that period of time, and the asset itself, if you were to adjust for inflation, would probably not change much, but your financing costs would now be less than it was back then. So,
but we also know a lot of people got second and third mortgages. I mean, they use their house as a kind of a piggy bank.
Yes, that's distinctly right, and of course that was a huge issue that in the last housing boom that got us into so much trouble was that people were typically, how that's worked is that housing being a non-depreciating asset and you being forced to apply money through your mortgage to pay down the debt means that you have a cushion, and that cushion has typically allowed us to ride out housing downturns, because back before the late 90s, 20% down payments were fairly standard, and that already provided a cushion. And then once you pay that down even more, you can ride out some housing downturns. And those housing, there's no market that's as prone to booms and busts as housing. But the trouble is, once it became readily available to pull the equity out of your home, then people, of course, did so, and
sure,
that did leave
sure.
Create the vulnerabilities for foreclosures and negative equity.
Well, let me pick up on this, Todd, and actually go back to you. And in terms of people that want to buy a home today, it seems that you do need more money down than you did a couple of years ago. There are just more hurdles, it seems to me, that someone has to go through today than they did, let's say, 5 years ago to get a house. True.
Yeah, I think there are two parts to that. Well, I mean, sort of more hurdles today than there were 5 years ago is probably an excellent thing.
Because there were people that just literally could not afford.
So I tend to think that we have not had a housing problem in this country. We had a leverage problem, right? Because if you own a house and it drops in value by 50%, and let's say you are not about to retire, you still have the same house. It's still the same bedrooms. It's still in the same school district. Everything about it's the same except its paper value, right? And then eventually, as the caller said, that house price is going to go back up on paper, but it's still the same house, and you can't sell it and buy something else because you got to buy another house, right? So the price moves on paper don't matter unless you're going to use your house as a piggy bank. So using your house as a piggy bank is a bad idea. Now, banks these days are less willing to extend loans to borrowers who risk your credit. They are documenting more. I could tell you stories about colleagues of mine at Penn, tenured professors who had trouble getting mortgages 3 years ago because of the documentation requirements. And you figure if the real estate faculty have trouble getting mortgages, then the average person, they're probably not having an easy time of it. And that's been a barrier to people returning back to the housing market. But that's starting to ease up. It's starting to ease up with the prime market. It's going to ease up with riskier borrowers just because banks can make money off of lending, even at a 3.5% interest rate. But the issue is going to be, are they able to sell them to Fannie and Freddie? And
they're such a big player, though.
And that's they're pretty much almost all the housing market right now. And so that's going to be kind of up to Washington.
Let me get some more callers in at 1-888-477-9499. We've got Jacqueline from Fishtown joining us. Jacqueline, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
My question is, with the market improving, if a person were planning to go FHA, I found in the past that FHA was including foreclosures in the prices that they would allow their purchasers to offer. And I was wondering if that's still going to happen. I'm the owner, and I'm in a gentrified area, Fishtown, mm-hmm. and in 2007 I put a house up for sale at a reasonable price, but I got 125% offer, and the reason was that FHA would not go for the gentrification price. It would, because it had thrown all the foreclosures in the whole city into the bucket. Can you tell me if that's still going to happen?
Well, you know what, Jacqueline? It's an interesting and a very specific question. And Todd, Todd, if I can, Stan, if I could toss that to you. This is a part of Philadelphia that has grown exponentially and is becoming gentrified. Can you answer Jacqueline's question?
Well, it sounds like her question was probably in the underwriting phase for an FHA, or looks like maybe her buyers were FHA, using an FHA-endorsed mortgage, and the underwriting or the appraisal that came back was using foreclosure resales in order to price the home, and therefore the value was quite low. And I guess I can tell you that I'm not exactly current on what FHA guidelines would be. Typically, appraisers have been loath to use foreclosure resales in their appraisals. Of course, given the dearth of regular sales during the housing downturn, oftentimes they were pressed into having to use them. And then they do have guidelines that when you have to use a foreclosure in an appraisal, you should adjust the foreclosure for the foreclosure discount, mm-hmm. which of course then begged the question, what was the foreclosure discount in your area, which became hard to figure out. But Yes, it is generally our view is that the foreclosure, the distressed and non-distressed markets do trade at substantially different levels, even in periods of time in which markets are very highly saturated with foreclosure inventory. So, for example, if you look at stock in California in 2008-2009, where more than 70% of the transactions were foreclosure related, a non-foreclosure was still selling at a premium relative to a foreclosure. And the reason for that is because typically there are differences in the condition of the home, the motivation of the seller. The seller is typically a bank in a foreclosure case, and they're much more motivated to sell than a traditional seller. And then there's generally fear and uncertainty and doubt by the buyer, which leads to a discount on a foreclosure home because you're buying it. There's no disclosure from the previous seller. You're buying it as is. There's a number of factors that drive that the price to be lower than a non-distressed home.
Jacqueline, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Let me see what Michelle from Williamstown, New Jersey has to say. Michelle, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning, everyone. I'm intrigued by this discussion because I am an investor in houses right now because of the low prices of foreclosures, the availability of foreclosures for flipping. And what I've been noticing is that there are quite a number of short sales out there, plenty more than foreclosures, mm-hmm. which are more of what I'm looking for. And from what I understand, and correct me if I'm wrong, the banks are holding on to the short sale status and not turning them into foreclosures. And I'm wondering how they're able to do that since they're not getting, as far as I know, payments on those loans. And I'm wondering how they are able or what's going on, maybe the relationship between the banks and the government that's holding back on those short sales turning into foreclosures and what you foresee happening.
Michelle, just a quick question to you as someone who you see yourself as an investor who flips homes. Is this a profitable enterprise for you?
More profitable if I can get a foreclosure. I like to pay cash, invest money into fixing it up, and then putting it back on the market. And if I can get a foreclosure price, I can make a pretty good
money.
Turnaround.
And I'm just curious, what part of you're from Williamstown, New Jersey. Are you looking here in this area or other parts of the country?
South Jersey area and also in Delaware.
And also in Delaware. Well, let me actually toss first to you, Todd, just because it's interesting to hear from someone. I mean, this is part of the real estate market, the idea of investors coming in, buying something low, fixing it up, and trying to make a profit off it.
Oh, absolutely. The the role of the investors in this market has been sort of arbitraging us out of the bottom of the bus, right? So we've already noticed that house prices, the pendulum on the house prices swung really far up in 2007 and really far down by 2010, 2011. And so if you can buy a house cheap enough, as Michelle is doing, through a foreclosure sale, and then you clean it up and you sell it not in a foreclosure sale, then there's real profit to be made. Mm-hmm. Foreclosure sales are tough places to try and buy a house, and so there's a real discount to getting houses through them and taking the risk that these investors are taking. And so they're doing a very important job of cleaning up the bottom of the housing market. In some markets, about 30% of sales are to investors like Michelle. Now, why banks are hanging on and having them be
short sales.
There are lots of possible reasons, including what their balance sheet looks like, what they think their expectation about future house prices are going to be. And I think it's going to depend on the bank, but I'm not quite sure.
Is there a short answer to that, Stan?
Well, I mean, the very reason they're doing more short sales is because the reason of what Michelle gave, that she prefers the foreclosure because it's a cheaper price.
Right.
So from the bank's perspective, who, of course, wants the higher price, that's why they're doing short sales. Foreclosures are very expensive to banks because they end up getting much less money for that asset than if they were able to negotiate with the current homeowner and sell it as a short sale. So we're seeing much higher growth in short selling, which I think overall is more efficient for the marketplace. Banks recoup more of their assets, and people are able to get homes back on the market more quickly than the foreclosure process. Unfortunately, it's at a higher price, which doesn't help Michelle. But
do you think, Stan, that what Michelle and others are doing, which are investors who are buying cheap and flipping houses, that's an important driver when we look at the real estate market?
It's a huge driver in many markets. I don't know. I mean, probably a non-trivial driver definitely in Philadelphia, but it's been a huge driver in hard-hit markets like Vegas and Phoenix and Southern California and Central Valley of California, huge driver, at the height of the market, I mean, investors have made up probably more than 50% of those sales. So a huge part of, and investors have been a great part of that market because they were the ones who waded back into the housing market before anyone else because they typically have long horizons. They're going to hold that asset for 10, 20 years. So they don't care whether their home prices are going to fall for a little bit for the next year. So they were waiting back in 2009, 2010 and buying up homes, which helped to stabilize and put a floor into the market. So I think investors are definitely serving the traditional real estate investor is serving a great function in the current market, where essentially we're having to take a home ownership, a housing stock that was built for 70% home ownership rate, and reorient it towards one or more appropriate for, say, 64% home ownership rate, which is probably where we'll net out. So people like Michelle are definitely serving a very useful function there.
And Todd, I've read about people doing what Michelle does and paying cash. I mean, using, this is a cash transaction.
Absolutely. And I think an important thing for the non-investor to pay attention to when they're looking at what's going on in the markets is that the investors are cleaning up the bottom of the market, right? So they are the prices fell quite low, and a lot of markets lower for a existing house and what it would cost to build a new one. And so what happens in those situations, the investors come in and they bid the prices up, and those prices start jumping up fairly quickly at the beginning of a recovery. And then they moderate out. And so investors are very disciplined. As Michelle said, she doesn't want to buy a house that's too expensive. So once the house prices have come back to a reasonable level, the investors are going to clear out, right? The Blackstones of the world are sort of at the point where the private equity fund investors, that they're not going to be interested in buying distressed houses anymore either. And so you get a big initial jump in house price growth rates, but you don't want to extrapolate that the 20% in Phoenix is going to happen next year or the year after or the year after, just because it did right now.
Michelle, thanks for the call. Let's see what Lorraine from Downingtown has to say. Lorraine, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I would like your guests to comment on the fact that for average people, their mortgage is the only thing that they can write off on their taxes. So, you know, when people were getting second mortgages, it seemed like kind of a good deal, and it seemed like an important and smart thing to do. It was encouraged by government policy,
sure.
And now we're in this situation. So I'll take my answer off the air. Thanks.
Yeah, you're very welcome, Lorraine. Thanks for calling into Radio Times. A couple of minutes before we have to say goodbye, but Stan, I guess if I can toss that to you, and there are people that are talking about or looking at the mortgage deduction and whether it should still be in the tax code. What are your thoughts in 30 seconds?
Well, in general, I think that the mortgage interest deduction is going to come under a lot of scrutiny. I think we are set to undertake a tax reform sometime in the next year. I expect it to hit the legislative calendar. MID will be under definitely a lot of scrutiny because it's a very expensive tax expenditure. I tend to think it's probably not going to, at worst, it's going to get trimmed. We'll probably lose the deduction for second homes or probably homes over mortgages of $500,000 or more. And it's unlikely, actually, that will even happen. I think more likely we'll end up with a compromise where all deductions are capped at some limit, so no specific deduction is hit, but rather the totality of the deductions that one can take will be capped.
What do you think, Todd?
Yeah, I think the caller is exactly right. In the late 1980s, when the personal interest deduction was eliminated, we saw mortgage borrowing go up because that was still tax deductible. The question is, how does Washington limit it at all? Right? It's been a very hard tax break to get rid of. There are some very strong special interests and cities in favor of it. If it does hit, it's going to affect high-income households. They're the ones who benefit the most from it. It's a $500,000 limit. It's not binding on more than 7% of the population, something like that. And so it will affect only the certain towns and cities that have those households as residents.
Well, my thanks to both of you for joining us today on Radio Times. Todd Sonne, thank you very much.
Thank you, Marty.
And also to you, Stan Humphries, thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. Pleasure to be with you.
Nice to have you both with us. Stan Humphries, Chief Economist for Zillow. Todd Sinai, Associate Professor, Real Estate, Business Economics, and Public Policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. We appreciate those phone calls to Radio Times. You can check us out. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. You can check us out on Facebook, Twitter, email, archives, podcasts. It's all there. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, but stay with us. We'll be right back.